Great to have you along today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. Thanks so much for joining us as we begin the show by talking about your skin care with our guest, Dr. Apple Bodemer. She is a dermatologist, professor in the Department of Dermatology at UW-Madison and comes by every so often to talk with us. So as we visit with Dr. Bodemer today, I hope you'll join in. Do you suffer from adult acne? What treatments have made it better? Let's take a look at sunscreen. How often have you been applying sunscreen this summer? What questions do you have about skin cancer? Join the conversation. Number to call is 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@WPR.org. Love to hear from you. Dr. Apple Bodemer, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
It's good to be here, Larry.
Let's talk about acne to begin, adult acne. Most people probably know what it looks like, acne, but describe what's happening to your skin when you develop a pimple.
Well, there's a couple of key steps that happen in the development of a pimple or blemish. And one of the things that happens with acne is we get what we call excess skin cells will build up inside the hair follicles, causing a blockage of that pore. We call that hyperproliferation, or that buildup of skin cells. When that happens, oil will get blocked. So instead of going, like, just flowing out of the hair follicle to cover the skin, it can build up inside that hair follicle. Additionally, there are hormonal drivers that trigger the oil glands to go into overdrive and make more oil. And so the combination of that really sets you up for getting this blocked, plugged pore. And that causes bacteria that are normally present on the skin to kind of throw a party. There's a lot more food for them to eat. They start inviting all their friends and start making more bacteria, and that causes a lot of inflammation. So it's kind of just a big mess that starts to happen underneath the skin that leads to inflammation, and it's kind of all of it together. When we have a whitehead or blackhead, that's just kind of the plugging happening. But with the inflammation, if that hair follicle bursts underneath the skin, that can create even more inflammation and can lead to these painful, what we call nodulocystic lesions or big nodules.
Hard, painful cysts.
Yeah.
Yeah. Are there different types of acne? I imagine there are.
Yes. I mean, we have kind of the more standard acne. And so acne can be broken down into the types of acne lesions we have. So there's comedones, which are whiteheads and blackheads. And a blackhead is really just an open comedone, meaning that the oil, instead of having a little covering of skin over it, keeping it white, it gets oxidized when it gets exposed to air. So a lot of people see the blackheads and think that that's dirt building up inside the hair follicles. And that's not. That's actually your natural oils oxidating when they get into contact with air. And then there's the papules and pustules, or inflammatory acne, and then the nodulocystic, and then the scarring acne. So all of, you know, we can kind of differentiate it based on the types of acne lesions a person has, and many people have a combination of them. We also see standard kind of teenage acne, which we sort of expect to see in most teens, at least in our culture. And then there's another bump in acne that we tend to see more in middle age or even later adulthood that tends to have a stronger hormonal drive to it.
So I'm wondering how our hormones relate to acne then? I mean, I remember back when I was a teenager, it was a painful year or two for me.
Yeah.
For sure. Was it raging hormones?
Well, I mean, naturally during puberty, hormones rise up. And we see that the androgens in particular, the male type hormones, and females have androgens as well, but they tend to drive the hair follicle to cause this hyperproliferation, or the skin cells to build up inside the hair follicle, and also the oil glands to produce more oil. And so we'll see that peak, but it's a real complicated picture because it's not just the levels of hormones. If it were just that, we would expect all guys to get acne, and as, you know, women, we shouldn't. But there are other hormones that play a big role, too, and it's the relative amounts of hormones. So when estrogen levels start to fall, which we can see after menopause, or we can see in certain conditions that we consider hyperandrogenetic, or things like metabolic syndrome. We see this in diabetes, and we see it in polycystic ovary syndrome, where androgen levels get really out of balance when it compared to estrogen levels. And so that falling estrogen or lower estrogen related to androgen can drive acne as well. But there are some other hormones as well, including insulin, like growth factor. That's one that can really drive androgen production, or those male type hormone productions, and also can directly impact the hair follicle.
I'm wondering about cosmetics and maybe hair products. Can they cause acne, if I'm not mistaken, or am I?
Yeah, no, if there is a lot of things that are really blocking the pores, so heavy use of very thick cosmetics can cause the hair follicles to get blocked. And, you know, this was a popular thing on social media. I was seeing a lot of people talking about slugging, or thick layers of Vaseline on the skin, which is really, really great for somebody who has really dry skin and is not prone to blemishes, but can really wreak havoc on acne by causing more blockage of the pores. We also see physical acne, where there's chronic rubbing or compression of the skin. In athletes in particular, we'll see that with football players or lacrosse players, athletes that wear helmets, that can really aggravate acne. Chlorine can also aggravate acne, so we can see that in swimmers sometimes, where the chlorine really dries the skin out and causes the oil glands to kind of go into overdrive trying to protect the skin.
You have, I'm sure, some ideas about lotions and creams that don't clog pores. There must be some out there.
Yes, and most things will be labeled as anti-comedogenic. So if you have problems with acne and you're looking for makeups, cover-ups, things like that, you'll want to look for that. One of the other things, too, goes with the amount that you're putting on, because for some people, a very thin layer, even of something as thick as Vaseline, can be helpful. I recommend a lot of plant-based oils. I think they can be wonderful. They're full of antioxidants and have some anti-inflammatory properties. But I remind my patients, it's 2 or 3 drops to moisturize your face. We shouldn't be splashing handfuls of oil on our face, because it has to do with the amount that can...
Yeah, I can see that happening. There's an idea that if you eat too much chocolate, you're going to break out.
Mm-hmm.
Is that an accurate claim?
Yes. Unfortunately, it does appear that some people are chocolate sensitive. So this isn't everybody, but there have been some studies. And when I first was reading about this, I thought, well, that's the milk chocolate. That's the, you know, kind of the Hershey's lower quality chocolate. But it does appear that even high quality dark chocolate can cause some people to break out. One of the other things that goes along with this is most of us, when we're eating chocolate, it might come in the form of a candy bar or have other added sugars. Any foods that are really high in simple sugars, meaning not associated with fiber or that are highly processed, can really drive acne through insulin and insulin-like growth factor pathways.
A listener emailed us. They're in their late 20s, have pillar cysts on their scalp that they inherited, I think, from their mom's side, and we can talk about genetics too. But at the moment, they probably have 12 or so of these cysts on their scalp, and they've had them since they were a tween, and some are quite large. Never had them removed, but they've been thinking of making a dermatological appointment. Is removal worth it? Anything she can do to reduce them or keep them from coming back?
Yeah, not really. So pilar cysts are little cysts that grow on the scalp, and they can be quite large. They can be painful. They usually are movable. So if you kind of put your finger on it, you usually can move them around a little bit. And genetics definitely play a role with these types of cysts. They're not related to acne. It's kind of luck of the draw. If you're prone to them, you're prone to them. And in terms of getting them removed, the way that we remove them is we cut into the scalp. Of course, we numb the area up first, but it is a small surgical procedure to remove those cysts. If the cyst comes out all in one piece, which they often do, but not always, then they're not likely to come back. But you, if especially if she's got that many, it's likely that she could get new ones. I would say get them removed if they bother you. If they're not bothering you, there's no reason they need to be removed.
Makes good sense. Well, let's say you wake up in the morning and notice you have a pimple on your face. What should you do in order to heal that spot as quickly as possible?
Well, the number one thing not to do is pick at it. And that's really hard to avoid that temptation for most of us. But any picking, scratching, or aggressive rubbing that you do is going to increase your risk for scarring. Acne typically will go away on its own without scarring when it's in kind of the mild to mild moderate category. There are some people who have very severe nodulocystic acne, and scarring can be very significant for them, even if they're keeping their hands off of it. But that's the first thing is treat it gently. There are over-the-counter washes and spot treatments that you can use. Benzoyl peroxide and salicylic acid are two that are really readily available and easy to find. These new colloid dressings, or their little acne pimple stickers, they can work really well for a couple of different reasons, because there's a little, it just kind of provides a nice environment for the skin to heal, and it also helps us keep our fingers off of them.
Yeah. Is it ever a good idea to squeeze a pimple?
No. No, you know, because if we think about it, it's kind of like imagining a little balloon underneath the skin. So if you have a white head or a black head and we start squeezing two sides of it, then if you imagine what a balloon would do in that situation, it's going to pop out the other two sides. And that can cause kind of these mini explosions underneath the skin, which draws inflammation and irritation and kind of keeps the whole cycle going a lot more robustly than we would like. If you do feel the need to what we call express them, there are little tools that you can get that are metal and they have a tiny hole in the center. They're called comedone extractors, and you can find them at Walmart or Target or online. And you can apply those. The difference with that is it's applying an even pressure around the perimeter or around the edges of that acne lesion. And if it's ready to clear itself out, then it will. Sometimes you might apply one of these comedone extractors and it might not pop. And in that case, you might want to use a warm compress. So just a little bit of a warm wet washcloth and hold it on the area for 2 to 5 minutes. And then you could try again if you're really determined to get rid of that whitehead.
Yeah. And if it gets infected, what do you do? Anything?
Well, most of the time it's inflammation. Occasionally acne can get infected. Usually that's associated with a lot of picking. And that is something that if that's commonly happening, then you should seek out the help of a physician.
Our guest today, Dr. Apple Bodemer, a dermatologist and professor in the Department of Dermatology at the UW-Madison. Great to have her back with us. And if you have questions, we're talking acne now, but I also want to get into sunscreens and perhaps skin cancer with her. You can join in. The number to call is 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking about skin care and your skin health with our guest, Dr. Apple Bodemer, dermatologist and professor in the Department of Dermatology at UW-Madison. Dealing with acne right now, but we're also want to get into sunscreens and sunburn and that sort of thing as well. And again, join in 800-642-1234, email to talk@WPR.org. Cameo in Oshkosh will give you a chance to join in. Thank you for calling.
Hi.
Hi, great to have you along.
Yeah, good to be here.
And you have a question.
Yes, I do. So I had surgery when I was younger, like 15 years ago. So I had, I have scar tissue behind my ears. And like, it was, you know, 15 years ago, the scars are fully healed. But I do tend to get acne right on the edge of those scars. And I was just wondering, like, if there's a reason for that or if there's a way to stop that from happening, because it is quite painful.
Hmm.
Yeah, one thing that can happen with scars is we can get cysts. And Well, acne is a type of cyst. We call, you know, there are some cystic appearances to acne. Epidermal inclusion cysts or milia are two other types of cysts that are common in scar tissue. So that would be important to distinguish exactly what's going on, especially if it's within the scar tissue or right along the edge of it. Those types of, with the inclusion cysts, they need to be removed surgically. So sometimes they can be, you know, drained, or if you are able to express the material, they just come right back in the same spot. So if that's happening, then it's not actually acne, but it's more in this cyst category. And if they are painful, it might be worth checking in with a physician to see about having them removed.
Yeah, that makes sense. Somebody else wondered about washing your face. How often should you wash your face to treat or prevent acne?
Once or twice a day is really all you need. I think you can do a lot more damage by over-cleansing, especially if you're using harsh chemicals to cleanse with. A lot of people have the idea that acne comes from dirty skin, and that's not the case. If we over-dry the skin using harsh soaps, that actually triggers the oil glands to do what they're supposed to do, which is to protect the skin. And so we want to be careful that the cleansers that we use should be gentle cleansers, not harsh antibacterial soaps, especially on the face, especially if you're prone to acne.
And when is it time to see a dermatologist about your acne?
If your acne is leading to scarring or it's interfering with your life, then those would be two reasons to check in. And if it's mild, you could even check in with your primary care doctor who might be able to give you a few tips, and that might be all it takes. If it's more significant or severe, then checking in with a dermatologist would make sense.
Pam in Wausau has a different sort of question, I believe. Let's go there. Hi, Pam.
Hi.
What's on your mind?
Well, I had a Mohs surgery done on my nose for skin cancer. And what I want to know is, how do you know afterwards whether you should go back in or whether it's healing properly?
Yeah, so the Mohs procedure, so typically it depends a little bit on where you are after the procedure. It takes a year for a scar to settle down. And if you have concerns about the wound, if there's drainage or pain or redness that is not symmetric, so there's going to be some redness and discomfort during the healing process, but that should be in the kind of immediate healing process. Those would be things that you could check in with your surgeon's office about. A lot of times nursing staff can take care of questions if you have concerns. Typically, once the area has healed, it's a good idea to get a skin check about 6 months after the procedure and see where things are at with the rest of your skin. The highest risk for developing a second skin cancer is within those first couple years. And so having your skin looked at and then paying attention to your own skin. So skin self-checks are really the most powerful tool you have to detecting something early and getting it caught early.
Pam, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or email to talk@WPR.org. Love to hear from you. Jeff wonders, would you recommend men not shave their face if they have acne?
Well, if you are struggling with acne or folliculitis, which is a little bit different than acne but similar, then shaving can often make it worse, or it can be painful. So that would be a personal call. There are certainly things that you can do if your acne is mild, and especially if it shows up right after shaving. Shaving can cause a lot of irritation to the skin. So using a light moisturizer or a few drops of a plant-based oil to kind of moisturize the skin and keep it supple can go a long way to helping offset the irritation and the irritant folliculitis that can happen from shaving.
I've heard that sleeping with a silk pillowcase might be gentler on your skin and reduce acne. How much can your pillowcase influence your skin's health?
Well, most of us, as long as you're keeping your pillowcase clean, I know that that's been a big thing, and my kids all came home saying that they needed a silk pillowcase. I think there hasn't been any real clear data on that, is what I would say. If you like your silk pillowcase, then it is still important to wash it frequently. And because silk takes a little bit more care, I think it can be tempting sometimes to maybe not wash it as frequently as you'd need to. But it should be getting washed about once a week at least, and that you still go through regular pillowcase care. But a lot of the cotton pillowcases are really soft and gentle on the skin as well.
Bill in La Crescent, Minnesota, we'll go to you now. Hi, Bill.
Hello. Question about my scalp. I have some little outbreaks. I guess you can call them pimple-like things. Mm-hmm. Four or five of them. They eventually form a little scab. What are those? What do I do about those?
Yeah, it sounds like it could be in that folliculitis category, which is irritation of the hair follicles. There's bacteria all over our skin, and it sounds like if they're getting kind of crusted and scabbed, you might be having a little bit of bacteria show up. That will do that anytime the skin gets broken down. I would start with a salicylic acid-based shampoo, which you'll find in the anti-dandruff section. So that's something that might be helpful. If that's not enough, you might want to see your doctor. Sometimes a topical antibiotic can be helpful to just dab on these areas as spot treatment, depending on if it looks like it's in that kind of folliculitis category.
Makes sense.
But that's where I start.
And while we're talking about shampoos, I just read somewhere where whoever wrote the piece said you shouldn't use shampoo every day. It could harm your scalp if you used it every day. Is that true?
I think it really depends. That's kind of an individual call, because especially for teens who tend to make a lot of oil, they sometimes need to wash every day just to keep their hair from getting too greasy, especially if they're athletes and they're having a lot of friction from helmets or things like that. As we get older, our oil glands do tend to settle down overall. And so by the time we get, to middle or later life, we probably don't need to be washing our hair every day. It also depends on how harsh the shampoos that you're using are. And some people that have dandruff, if their dandruff is really bad, they might need a harsh medicated shampoo every day to try to keep their scalp condition settled down. And as they start to get improvement, they can back off to using those medicated shampoos once or twice a week to hold things at bay. So I think it really is individual. And for the most part, most of the shampoos that you can get over the counter are not going to do a whole lot of damage. And for most people who have relatively healthy scalps, it's more a preference issue.
Frank in northern Wisconsin has a question for us. Let's go there. Hi, Frank.
Hello.
What's on your mind?
My wife has a history of breast cancer a couple years ago, and one of the doctors suggested that she is prone to skin cancer because of that history, and I wondered what your guest had to think about that.
Well, there are some mutations, so that would be something somebody would know if they had some genetic testing. That can be associated with melanoma. Most people with breast cancer don't get melanoma and don't necessarily have a higher risk of melanoma. But for families where we see things kind of run alongside each other, with a pancreatic cancer is another one that we can see associated with melanoma. I think for all of us, it's important to just check our skin and be comfortable with the kinds of spots our body makes, and to be aware of if something starts changing or you develop a new spot. Skin cancer is a broad category, and there's a whole lot of other skin cancers, basal cell and squamous cell, which are by far and away the most common types of skin cancer. And there really isn't any association of those specifically with breast cancer. That really has more to do with how much UV radiation exposure you have over the course of your lifetime and your skin type, how fair your skin is.
There you go, Frank. Thank you for calling. Mark in Madison, we'll go to you. Hi, Mark.
Hi. I have a couple sunscreen-related questions. Mm-hmm. So one is they tend to be effective but impossible to wash off, even showering, rubbing with soap. We tend to use the mineral versions, and if you look in the ingredients, they virtually all have beeswax or some kind of wax. And I'm wondering, is there a brand that does not have that, or is there a way to remove it. The other quick question is, when will we see some of the superior sunscreen compounds that are approved in Europe but not in the U.S.? Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't know. The second question, I don't know when that's going to happen. I know that the FDA is getting a lot more pressure, especially in the last few years, as more and more reports have come out about some of the concerns with the chemicals that are commonly used in the chemical-based sunscreens here in the U.S. Hopefully sooner rather than later. Related to those mineral-based sunscreens that you're having a hard time washing off, there are a lot out there that are lighter in formulation, and the Environmental Working Group is a really great resource for finding those. I know some of the best ones, like Badger is a common one that's found, and that's a really, really thick, heavy one that I know I have a hard time getting that off of my skin, too. Just continuing to use soap and lather it up, eventually it will come off. But there are a lot of brands out there that are not quite so heavy that are mineral-based as well. So I'd encourage you to kind of look at the Environmental Working Group website. They put out a sunscreen guide every May and will rate many of the products that are on the market. It's a huge market. If you go to any Walgreens or Walmart or even grocery store, you'll see just so many things to choose from. So the Environmental Working Group can help kind of narrow things down. The other great thing that we have, at least here in Madison, is we have a couple of really great resources. And like places like the Willie Street Co-op really vet the products that they put on their shelf. And so if you know that if you find it at some place like that, and many other natural food stores do the same thing, and you could talk to the supplier of your pharmacy or natural food store to see how they decide what skin products to put on their shelves. And then that can give you some sense of confidence, knowing that, well, if you get it from a place that they've already done some of the legwork, then you can feel comfortable that whatever they're selling will be high quality. But it is, there's a lot of personal preference. What's too thick for me might not be too thick for somebody else, and vice versa. So there is a little bit of trial and error, but there's lots and lots of them in the market that aren't quite so heavy. So
there you go, Mark. Thank you for calling. A listener had emailed kind of in this area. They wear a foundation that has SPF in it. They're wondering how effective that is, or should they use an actual sunscreen instead of relying on their foundation? Their foundation is SPF 18.
Okay. So in general, when I'm looking for UV protection, we want an SPF of 30 or more. So if you're using a foundation that has an SPF of 18, that's not going to give you a whole lot of coverage, and you'll want to use an additional sunscreen on that. I also want to stress that sunscreen, I view really as a backup plan, that there are other protective behaviors that we can do that will decrease our risk of UV radiation exposure and decreases thus skin cancer risk and also the how quickly we age. And those include wide-rimmed hats, so a rim of at least 3, ideally up to 4 inches. Sunglasses with a wide lens will help protect the delicate skin around the eyes. Looking for shade when you can, trying to keep activities to the earlier morning and later afternoon and avoiding that in more intense midday sun. And then UV protective clothing. And they even have gaiters that you can pull up over your face, or if you're working outside, you can pull them up over your head and protect the neck, that are fairly lightweight and relatively cool, that if you're working outside in a garden or if you happen to be working outside in landscaping or construction, those kinds of things can really go a long way so that, you know, sunscreen is, we use it when we need it, but it doesn't have to be our primary defense.
Wondering about application now. I play golf, and when I walk 18 holes, typically I'll put some sunscreen on when I start, and then when I'm at the turn, after I've finished 9 holes, that's about 2 hours or so, mm-hmm. I'll put another application, usually while we're waiting for the people ahead of us to hit, mm-hmm. and then go for that application through to the end. Is that a reasonable thing to do?
Yeah, in general, if you have an SPF of 30 or more, and I, like I mentioned earlier, 30 is my kind of baseline for the low number, It needs to be reapplied at least every 2 hours. So you're probably doing okay. Unless you're sweating a lot and wiping the sweat off with a towel, your sunscreen is probably going right onto that towel. So that's one thing to be just paying attention to. If it's a cool day and you're not sweating very much, that's probably just fine. But if you're sweating a lot, you might need more frequent application.
Let's take a call from Mike in Plainfield. Mike, thank you for calling.
Yeah, I was diagnosed with a yeast infection in the groin and genital area about a week ago. And I was prescribed two creams. One is, I might kind of murder this pronunciation here, clotrimazole.
Uh-huh.
And the other one is triamcinolone.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And I'm just wondering, I'm supposed to apply that twice a day, which I normally been doing now morning and night. I normally shower at night and then put it on afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
But in the morning, should I be showering, getting totally clean first, and then applying it then too? I mean...
Yeah.
Yeah, no, you don't need to. If you're putting on at night, and it would be soaked in by the time, you don't need to wash the skin again in order to reapply it. So I would just be a little careful about that triamcinolone in terms of how long you're using it in the groin, because that is a steroid, and if they're used for too long, steroids can thin the skin out, and that's fairly delicate skin to begin with. So a lot of times, if we're going to use a steroid, we might use it just in the initial stages to help with some of the inflammation and discomfort, but then once, a short ways into the treatment, we might want to switch away and just use that anti-yeast medication.
Yeah, so a short ways, like a week or two, or?
I probably would aim more for a couple of days.
Oh.
And it just depends on how severe the inflammation is. So I haven't seen you, and I don't know how inflamed it was, but we might want to use it a little longer if there's a lot of inflammation.
Mike, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Julie in Little Suamico emailed us, what's the best way to treat the hives Julie gets every time she gets sick? Typically develop about 4 days after the onset of something like a cold or a respiratory illness. They're extensive with large areas of raised red and extremely itchy skin. Typically lasts more than a week.
Well, if this is something that's happening every time you get sick, it might be a good idea to seek medical help because there are things that you can do. Over-the-counter antihistamines would be the first place to start. But if the individual spots are moving around during that week, that you kind of get a really itchy raised spot that shows up and then it disappears within 24 hours and then you get them in other places, that is what true hives look like. But if you're getting spots that are raised and itchy and sticking around for longer, it might be a good idea to just have a medical professional look at it. And, a biopsy might be helpful just to make sure that there's not anything else going on.
All right. And again, you can join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234, or you can email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. Talking today with Dr. Apple Bodimer, dermatologist, professor in the Department of Dermatology at UW-Madison. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Dr. Apple Bodimer, dermatologist and professor in the Department of Dermatology at UW-Madison. Questions about your skin, maybe an experience? I hope you'll join in. The number is 800-642-1234. Email to talk@WPR.org. Let's go to Diane in Verona. Diane, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi, I'm just finishing up an IV antibiotic therapy for Lyme disease, and so now I'm very tick conscious. I'm putting on off when I go outside to garden, and I'm just wondering, between sunscreen and the tick repellent, is there any protocol for which to apply first, or are they going to cancel out each other, or what does she know about that?
Well, it depends on how, like a lot of the insect repellents can be used on clothes. And so I don't know that there's a specific one right way to apply one versus first and then the other next. I would be inclined to put the sunscreen on because that typically is more of a cream base Most of the bug repellents that I'm familiar with are spray and more of a liquid that you kind of spray on either the skin or your clothes. So I think that would be my recommendation. If you are out gardening a lot, I'd really strongly recommend that you consider some of the UPF rated clothing. They have many different brands at many different price points. You'd want to look for a UPF of 50, which tells us that only 1/50th or only 2% of the UV radiation that hits the surface of the fabric will get through to your skin. And that holds up even when it does get wet or you get sweaty. So, and they do come very lightweight with ventilation and things like that too. So for people that are active outside or spend a lot of time outside in the middle of the day, like a gardener might, but I would, and that also will help you because that protective layer, the ticks aren't going to climb on your skin quite as readily, and it gives you an extra barrier.
Diane, thank you for calling. Appreciate it. Gina emailed us, what treatments are available for removing brown spots on the face? Are laser treatments a good option? And if so, what type would Gina look for?
Well, that's a really tricky question because there's a lot of different kinds of brown spots that can show up on the face, especially as we get older. Sun damage can cause hyperpigmentation in a couple of different ways, and it would be really important to identify specifically what type of pigment you're dealing with first before you'd be able to determine whether a laser will be useful or not, or specifically which type of laser. It also matters what your baseline pigmentation is in the skin, because if you do have a little more pigment, or if you have higher pigment in your baseline skin, then you have to be a little bit more cautious with lasers. So I would say it'd be a good idea to get a sense for what the pigment is that you're trying to deal with and then go from there.
So see a dermatologist.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And sometimes primary care doctors, you know, they could tell you, well, is this a seborrheic keratosis, which tend to be a little bit more raised, but they can be flat as well, and those don't respond very well to lasers or light treatments or to creams.
Okay, makes sense. So often we get burned, even if we think we're being careful about sunscreen. Well, first, what are some common mistakes when people make when it comes to sunscreen, and then what if you do get burned?
Yeah, so the common mistakes are not applying often enough. As we talked about earlier, it should be reapplied at least every 2 hours or after getting wet. So if you put a sunscreen on and go swim in the pool for 30 minutes, get out, towel off, all your sunscreen is on your towel, you would definitely need to reapply it before you go sit in the sun again. The other big common mistake is not putting enough on. So one rule of thumb is a palm full for a body in a bathing suit. So kids are going to have smaller palms. They also have smaller bodies. And that's a heaping palm full. That's not just a little smear on the bottom of your palm, but a good handful, basically. And most of us are not putting that much on, but that's what they use in the laboratory environments where they determine SPF levels. So that's an important thing to consider. Make sure you're using enough. If you have a 6-ounce bottle, that shouldn't last you all summer. If you're spending a whole day at the beach, that might last you one day if you're applying it appropriately, which is, again, where those protective clothing comes in, because if it's covering your skin, you're protected, and when it's off of your skin, you know you're not protected anymore. And I think that gives you a little bit more of a reliable base than, you know, is some of it wiped off or has it worn off, or, you know, that sort of thing that we end up with sunscreen.
You know, we've talked about SPF. I think we mentioned UVA. I'm wondering about the difference among SPF, UVA protection, and UVB protection.
Yeah. The SPF really is a measure of how quickly you'll turn red in the sun. And that is a measure of the UVB protective qualities of that sunscreen. We don't have a really great way to measure how effective a sunscreen is at blocking the UVA rays. And the UVA rays can actually penetrate deeper into the skin. They tend not to cause quite as much burning, but they definitely can cause DNA damage, and leading to accelerated aging and to increased risk of skin cancer. It's one of the reasons that tanning beds are so very dangerous, is because they're predominantly UVA radiation, so you won't burn, but you also get this really big hit of UVA radiation to your skin cells, leading to aging and cancer. So That's and they I know that they've tried working on UVA measures, and we just aren't there yet. With sunscreens, the mineral-based sunscreens, which a caller brought up earlier, those do a good job of blocking both UVA and UVB. When it comes to the chemical-based sunscreens, some do a good job at one spectrum, others might do a better job at another spectrum, and often when you're using a chemical-based sunscreen, you'll have a small handful of chemicals in there, one to help stabilize those chemicals, and two to help kind of fill in the gaps.
What, how high, I mean, there are SPF of above 50. Mm-hmm. Do they actually provide better or longer lasting protection?
Not really. And I just saw that there's something was passed by the FDA that they're going to block anything over 50. So in the future, we won't be able to see sunscreen companies market SPF 100 or 75 even. I think that's actually a good move, because what those higher numbers do is tend to give people a false sense of security. Because whether or not the sunscreen could potentially give you extra protection at hour 4, it's already worn off. Our skin cells are sloughing off all the time, and the sunscreen will go with it. And so even if you're using an SPF of 75 or an SPF of 100, you still need to reapply it every 2 hours. And so that's why I see a minimum of SPF of 30. And if you want to go higher, you can, but you still have to reapply it.
Louise in Dodgeville, it's your turn. Hi, Louise.
Hi. I have a question about the little kind of red broken blood vessels that you get like around your nose, your cheeks, sometimes on your chin, and the best way to treat those.
Mm-hmm. Well, those can be a couple of causes. Rosacea is a common condition that can cause permanently dilated blood vessels or blood vessels that are enlarged on the face, especially that central face area, like the middle of the cheeks, the nose, and the chin. So that would be one thing to kind of flush out. The other major cause of facial redness is sun exposure. And over a period of time with a lot of sun damage, that sun breaks down collagen, which helps support the skin, but it also helps support those little blood vessels. And those little blood vessels get much more prone to staying dilated or staying more wide open and being visible. There aren't any real great topical creams that can address this effectively long term. And most of the time you'd be looking at covering up. So makeup type cover-ups can be useful, or looking at a light-based treatment or laser treatment.
Louise, there you go. Thank you very much for calling. Stan emailed us and wonders if you could talk about a rare skin problem he just read about minutes ago in a Yahoo Medical News report. It's a rare condition called acquired hypertrichosis lanugosa, I believe, HLA, which is the appearance of a whitish hair that grows in some areas that shouldn't have any hair. Stan has one coming out the front of his nose.
Okay. Well, so I think that those are probably two different things. If he has one hair that's growing out from the tip of his nose, that's just one active hair follicle. But I think what that condition is talking about is when people get sort of this velvety appearance of these fine, basically baby hairs. And we have hair follicles all over our body. And except for the palms and soles, we potentially, you know, some people will grow hair on their toes and some people will grow it on their nose. Some people grow it on their face more readily than others. But if it's the one kind of coarse white hair that might be growing off from the nose, that would be something that you could easily pluck if that's bothersome to you. But we can, you know, there's a couple conditions where we can see increased vellus hairs, and those are the hairs that we get on the arms that are not full terminal hairs. They tend to be more fine, and that's something that is kind of a development to help protect the body. And I'm not familiar with that specific. There's probably a genetic mutation in that specific condition, but it is very uncommon and not something that I've ever seen in my career.
Okay, so not very common at all. I'm wondering about the spray-on sunscreen versus the mm-hmm. lotion version. Now, frankly, I use that spray-on. I spray it on my hand mm-hmm. and then apply it. And then there's the lotion version. Is there any advantage to one or over the other? I use the one spray-on because it fits in my golf bag.
Yeah, and it's convenient. The spray-on sunscreens are convenient. And I think it is important to remember that UV radiation, we know, causes skin cancer. And we need to sort of take everything into account. So somebody who is fair and at risk for burning frequently, you know, that we sort of would want to take that into account. The sunscreen that you use is the one that's going to be the most effective. If, you know, we're really looking carefully at them, there are some problems with the spray-on sunscreens. And, you know, I had young kids at one point, and sometimes that's all you could do is just sort of spray them as they ran by, and you're getting at least a little bit on there. But the way that you're applying it is probably the best way to try to make sure that you're getting even layer, because if we're spraying it on, most of the sunscreen is going off into the environment, which those sunscreen chemicals are not great for the environment. One of the more recent things that's come under fire around the spray-on sunscreens is that many of them contain benzene, which is a potential carcinogen, and also difficult, you know, bad actor when it comes to the environment. The other thing that you can see with spray-on sunscreens, especially if people are spraying their face, is that you could inhale these chemicals. So rather than just having them sit on the skin and dealing with what potentially could be absorbed through the skin, if we're inhaling it, they're going to have a real different impact on our biology.
Yeah. You're scaring me.
Well, I'm a big fan of nighttime golfing. I think we should have more lit golf courses and or evening. It doesn't have to be the nighttime. But if you are fair skin, prone to sunburns, then maybe looking at not golfing in the middle of the day, wearing some of those protective clothing, and then using sunscreen, kind of as I mentioned earlier, as that backup plan, or for parts of the body that you can't cover up, is going to be more beneficial.
How much does getting a sunburn increase your risk of premature aging, aging?
Yeah, dramatically. It also depends a little bit on your skin type, but UV radiation will dramatically accelerate that. And there are some great pictures online of truck drivers that, you know, or there's one of a secretary where she sat at a window and she got the UV radiation through the window, and the other half of her face is completely not aged at all because she didn't have a life, I guess, outside of her secretarial work. Or in the instance of the truck driver, you see this dramatic difference in photo aging, and that gives us a real sense of what the sun can do in terms of our aging process. About 90% or possibly even more of what we consider aging is really photo aging. So, you know, that really is accumulation of sun exposure over time. So even just five peeling sunburns in childhood can double your risk of melanoma, which is a deadly form of skin cancer that is definitely increasing in incidence. We're seeing a lot more of melanoma now than we used to. And so, you know, those sunburns are, and it usually takes many years to see the downstream effects from that early onset DNA damage. So, you know, it's really important to try to avoid burns as best as you can. And for somebody that's got a little more pigment in their skin, they could maybe tolerate a little more sun exposure than somebody who has almost no pigment like me, I'll burn if I look outside on a sunny day.
You do have a fair skin, for sure.
Yeah.
Is that what got you into this whole business?
Actually, no. I think I did have some bad burns as a kid. I had sun poisoning when I was about 12. And, you know, as I lay in Florida and my family was all enjoying the beach, I thought, oh, this is just not for me. So that was long before I made the decision to become a dermatologist.
Well, Dr. Apple Bodimer, thank you so much for spending time with us today. I really appreciate it. And I hope you'll come back and be with us again. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. And thank you, callers, for all of your questions.
Dr. Apple Bodimer, a dermatologist and professor in the Department of Dermatology at UW-Madison. Coming up, we're going to have a little visit with author Mo Rocca. That next. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News and The Larry Mueller Show.